Discworld. It's Discworld podcast analysis. Yeah.
So I'm Josh, and I'm your unseen academical, returning at long last for the third and final episode on my favourite Discworld novel, Thief of Time. And in the first episode, I was in the mode, I think of when doing these podcasts and putting them together, as looking from the outside in. So taking these ideas about names and identity and seeing from outside sources and applying them to the book. And then there was the intertextual literary links episode there in the middle, which was meant to be part of this episode, and I think you can see some of the connections there if you imagine it as one big long. But for this final part, I am turning things around, going in the opposite direction. This is the mode where I'm looking from inside the book and taking ideas and themes and prompts from within the text itself as prompts to discuss things and ideas in the real world and just seeing where that leads me. So as with the other episodes I've done in this mode, this is less about sort of nailing down and making particular points or arguments about the text itself. It's just taking Pratchett's ideas and prompts and just seeing where they lead, finding interesting threads and following them, which this time include discussions of Aristotle and what it means to be human, religious and scientific conceptions of time, identity theory, historical and technological progress both in and outside of Thief of Time, the very notion of progress itself, its implications and representations in science fiction and utopian literature, human sense making, the end of history, 9/11, and the Book of Revelation, along with a final look at Susan's character development and Pratchett's engagements with existential despair. So you can see why this rather wide-reaching and, yes, thematically heavy episode, why I might have found it particularly intimidating, and why it may have taken a long time to put together and sort out, along with just being busy with lots of other things. When it came to editing this, I did notice that there seems to be a bit of a problem with my microphone connection. It seems like the volume is dropping in and out every now and then. I will see if I can fix that up for future recordings, or maybe even get another microphone. But yes, I've done my best to compress it and things to try and level that out. But yeah, the volume might dip in and out every now and then. And then, of course, there is a section right at the end where apparently the microphone just wasn't picking up at all. Thankfully, when that happens, it just defaults to my basic laptop mic, which doesn't sound too bad, but will sound echoier and more distant and out of place compared to the rest of the audio. Not a huge deal, just giving a heads up. But yeah, I think I've kept you guys waiting for long enough. So I'll shut up and we can get on with the show. Now, as Butler notes in his Pocket Essential Guide, Pratchett has played with time before Thief of Time, pointing out that in Weird Sisters, a whole period of time is removed to allow Prince John Tom to grow up, and that in Pyramids, the flaring of the pyramids brings past and present into collision, and also that the wizards visit the primeval dawn in the Last Continent as well. I would also add that Rincewind travels through time in Eric, and we also have the auditors trying to prevent the sun from coming up in Hogfather, which essentially equates to an attempt to stop time, if taken literally, rather than a metaphor for imagination. And that, of course, happens immediately prior to Thief of Time in the death sequence. So again, we see, you know, Pratchett scratching at ideas in the previous book and then them bleeding over into the next one, if I can use a graphic body horror metaphor there. The character of Time herself was also earlier alluded to in the 1994 Discworld Companion, wherein Pratchett and his co-author Stephen Briggs suggest that Time is in fact female, since they say time waits for no man, except for Wen, as it turns out in Thief of Time, and also sort of for Nanny Ogg to come into her own as a midwife for a given value of weight, although I guess, yes, she's not a man. But yeah, it's something Pratchett has dabbled with before. But Susan E. Foster explores the philosophy of time in relation to Pratchett's works further in her 2014 chapter on the importance of being in the right trouser leg of time, the Philosophy and Terry Pratchett Collection. As she explains, the auditor's ideals are very similar to those of Aristotle and other early Greeks, who postulated that the best existence was one in which perfection is achieved and change ceases. This is Plato's forms. The idealized forms are eternal and unchanging, whereas the imperfect physical world is inferior and mutable, which is a theme I'll be coming back to constantly as we continue this exploration. Now, another connection that Foster draws in this chapter is between Pratchett and Aristotle's conception conception of humanity. A lot of this rational humanist conception of humanity that Pratchett follows and forwards has its roots in Aristotelian philosophy, with Aristotle often quoted, including in Foster's article, and saying that man is a rational animal. So in following this thread, I consulted Christian Kitzmann's chapter analyzing Aristotle on the definition of what it is to be human from the 2019 collection Aristotle's Anthropology, wherein Kitzmann contends that although Aristotle repeatedly stresses that he regards rationality as the crucial differentiating characteristic of human beings, he nowhere defines the essence of what it is to be human in these terms, which is to say that while Aristotle says man is a rational animal insofar as that sets him, and I'm going to say him here because not only for convenience, but in the conception of the Greeks, men and women are literally different races of people, if you want to hark back to the Pandora myth and things. But yeah, Aristotle is saying that what sets humanity apart from other animals is that man is rational. So that is to say that Aristotle would probably instigate that women are not rational, but that is to say that what sets man apart from the other animals is that he is rational, but that isn't the only thing he is, and that is not even the definitive thing that man is. So man is the only rational animal, but man is not only a rational animal, is sort of the implication there. To delve into this a bit further, the passage usually invoked when attributing the definition of human beings as rational animals to Aristotle comes from his book Politics, wherein Aristotle writes, or is recorded as having written, I'm not sure about the authorship of Aristotle's philosophy, in the same way that there is no written, first-hand written remnant of Socrates. It's all second-hand from Plato. But in Aristotle's Politics, it is written that man is more of a political animal than any other gregarious animal is evident. Nature, as we often say, makes nothing in vain, and man is the only zoon legon echon. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Definitely not. Why the rest of the passage gets translated into English, and then this stays in a anglicized version of the ancient Greek, but this phrase, the zoon legon echon, is usually translated as rational animal or animal with rationality. This is where the quote is taken from. As Kitzmann points out, however, legon doesn't refer to reason or rationality, but rather refers to speech, right? Logos. So it's probably pronounced logon, the zoon logon echon. Yeah, this refers to speech, which Aristotle distinguishes from non-human animal communication, which he says is merely expressive, indicating pleasure or pain. I won't get started on all of that. Safe to say, I disagree that there isn't a bit more nuance to animal communication than that, but that is Aristotle's premise, at least. And regardless, as Kitzmann also points out, Aristotle also provides several other definitions of humanity elsewhere in his writing, wherein he frequently defines humans as two-legged animals, more often than rational or speaking ones, and in one instance even declares that only in humans is the belly hairier than on the back, which seems debatable, but this is sort of to evidence that just because he says man is rational in one place doesn't necessarily mean that is the be-all and end-all of it. Aristotle also continues in the passage I cited before about the zoon legon echon, that in addition to spoken language, it is also characteristic of man that he alone has any sense of good and evil, of just and unjust and the like, and that associations formed by humans are unique in that they are held together by a shared sense of justice and a shared awareness of the common good. You can see where we're getting the connections to Pratchett and the Death series here, right? This is the emphasis on justice and morality here. And Aristotle continues that humans have another side beyond their animality, for they are divine. And here we're getting to the crux of Aristotle's conception of humanity, or what makes it so special, allegedly, is not that man can think or speak, but that man is just, or aims at being just, right? That man has morality. And weirdly, this is connected to the two-leggedness, with Aristotle elsewhere contending that other animals' hearts, from which this just rationality allegedly stems, he said that other animals' hearts were compressed by the bulkiness of their upper parts, right, pushing down on their heart, and that's why they have to stoop over. But by contrast, humans have a lighter upper body and also stand upright, allowing the heart to produce more heat and therefore more moral reason, which he called nous, which is these days applied to sort of intuition, but in the ancient Greek context implies specifically divine intuition. And this is what Kitzmann contends is what Aristotle actually defines humans as.
that humans are not rational animals, they are divinely moral animals, or zoon-noon-a-tune, the essence-grasping animal. Which brings us, in some ways, back to Sartrean existentialism, in that regardless of whether existence precedes essence or is later defined through action, what is humanist about both Sartre and Aristotle's philosophy is the idea that this moral essence is understood and wielded by humanity, which perhaps more accurately reflects the Discworld Death's philosophy insofar as there is first-hand evidence of a divine creation, if not moral instruction necessarily, maybe something to explore when we get to small gods. However, there's also a link back to Aristotle's conception of time, because Aristotle takes this premise of divine inspiration and goes on to argue that since morality is divine and the divine is absolute, morality is therefore eternal and cannot change. I was going to say, we don't have the Ten Commandments yet, but although this is pre-Jesus in the New Testament, we of course have the Old Testament and just Abrahamic and Judaic teachings exist, of course. So this is to take the Ten Commandments and say, that is the law. Thou shalt not kill. That's it. There is no nuance or subjectivity or contextuality to it. It's just don't kill. Always don't kill. Never don't not kill. That's it. And it's never going to become something else. Don't kill for all eternity. Because Aristotle says the eternal cannot be based on observation, since what is observed can change. So quantum is right out. So there's a lot of complexity and nuance here. And I think that's where the distinction between the Aristotelian humanism and the Sartrean humanism comes in, where death would perhaps side more with Sartre and we get the flip of that there's no justice, it's just us, right? Initially, death is using that phrase to promote an Aristotelian conception of the world, and then through the experiences in Reaper Man, turns it around into an assertion of Sartrean humanism. So there's a lot of complexity and subtleties to these arguments. End of the day, though, Aristotle does kind of say that man is a rational animal, right? He actually says that man is a divinely moral animal, but only because he is a rational one, and he's only rational because he's divine. So it's a much of a muchness, really. I think perhaps that emphasis is more important from a, I guess, religious perspective, right? You could apply the Ten Commandments, as I just did, to this Aristotelian outlook, but he is, of course, appealing to more of a Platonic conception of morality and natural perfection. So once that, even if you want to maintain some kind of metaphysical or spiritual belief, culturally, we've progressed beyond that, which is not to say we've become better than it, but that we've moved on to other things. But yes, perhaps now our conception of rationality often aligns itself more readily with a secular existentialist conception rather than rationality being an inherently divine. And we find Pratchett somewhat splitting the difference in the Discworld, especially less so in Thief of Time, but more so in Hogfather with the whole rising ape thing. And indeed, in his 2016 book, The Chronometric Imaginary, Time, Literature, and Cartography After the Spatial Turn, Adam Barrow spends a full 5 pages of a chapter ostensibly dedicated to mapping the time of fantasy in the works of Salman Rushdie, instead analysing Thief of Time. And based on his reading there, Barrow argues that the most important qualities that humankind has evolved to distinguish it from the non-human are those intangible and ephemeral indices of civilization that are, in essence, magical in their resistance to spatial or temporal positioning and catalogue. This is sort of saying that whether divinely inspired or socially constructed, the idea of morality is metaphysical. It is beyond the genetic makeup, right? You're not going to break apart a civilization and be able to examine morality under a microscope, which is reflected in Thief of Time when Pratchett writes that for something to exist, it has to have a position in space and time. Humanity practically was things that didn't have a position in time and space, such as imagination, pity, hope, history, and belief. Take those away and all you had was an ape that fell out of trees a lot. And Pratchett's being flippant and funny here, but Barrow says that Pratchett's nonsense, for all its scattershot whimsy, articulates a coherent temporal politics of rhythmic interrelatedness and a belief in the power of human beings to make and shape their own temporalities. So even from Pratchett's physicalist humanist perspective, we're getting this assertion that humans are somehow not inspired but transcending, and that they're not embodying or possessed by anything else, but somehow transcending not just their limitations but bodies in general. Now I think there's some debate to be had about this, like whether, I mean, this is essentially a dualist assertion that the mind mind is somehow beyond the physical, and that abstract concepts aren't somehow, right, I guess the concepts aren't the brainwaves, but the experience of thinking and understanding is somehow disconnected from the actual brain functions that produce or at least correlate with it, right? This is the being able to describe red from a black and white TV program thought experiment that I was talking about in the other episode, which I did, revisiting that book, I did have a note in the margins of my textbook that that guy had recanted his argument. I don't have any details and I didn't follow it up in that experiment. It's still often cited and still influential. But yeah, all of this sounds very Aristotle-y. Where Pratchett diverges from this, and I think again aligns himself with Sartrean existentialism, is that we have death telling Susan, your insight is valuable, that you have ways of thinking that will be useful. You can go where I cannot. I have only seen the future, but you can change it. And therein, I think, lies the important distinction between Aristotle and Pratchett, in that although their conceptions and emphasis upon rationality and morality are quite similar, for Aristotle, morality is universal and unchanging. But for Pratchett, morality is individual, or at least individually asserted, and can be changed and muted. And indeed, death himself, who is ostensibly eternal, is made more human because he observes and in turn is changed by his observations of humanity. So in true Pratchett fashion, it was all quantum, actually. More important than Aristotle and classic philosophy for Pratchett and the death sequence, though, I think, is that Christianity also promises changeless eternity as a reward to those who live a good life and worship God correctly. Right, this is the reward for the protagonists at the end of the Chronicles of Narnia, that they're taken out of time and into a new sort of pure and good existence. As Foster points out, however, for Pratchett, eternal unchanging existence is the antithesis of a good or happy life. And indeed, he contends that life itself is the process of change. And Pratchett also presents the idea of death, which in many ways is the ultimate change, albeit a permanent one, as necessary. This is reiterated through characters like Lady Lejeune in Thief of Time, but also Wendell Poons in Reaper Man, and Morton Isabel in, well, Mort, who all want to die rather than live outside of time and with the immortal death. Susan as well, who chooses to live as a human rather than with her grandfather. In contrast to this, we have Albert, who chooses to live outside of time and is forever in stasis. And there's, I don't know if Albert is necessarily demonized for this choice, but given his contrast to all the other more heroic characters, there is something to his presentation that suggests that his choice is the immoral, incorrect one. I mean, he's done it through dark magic and wizardry, so maybe that's carrying a lot of baggage that has been accumulated by other fantasy authors that Pratchett is playing on there, rather than being in the text itself. But it is interesting that he is the only character who is not punished for making this choice to want to exist outside of time and never change. Right? He is quite comfortable in his daily routines and things that he takes up as death's caretaker. In the Philosophy and Terry Pratchett collection, we also have Erica Neely, who points out in her chapter on death, the auditors, and the importance of individuality, that death himself would lack a function in a world without life. And then she half-heartedly suggests that perhaps he seeks to thwart the auditors in Thief of Time merely to preserve his own importance. Again, that is a throwaway suggestion rather than something Neely is actually arguing. But there is something to this idea of what happens to death if the auditors succeed. There is a sense of self-preservation to a lot of his plans, even though he is presented as, you know, this sort of selfless guardian of humanity. Moreover, in the Book of Revelation, which I'll talk about a bit more later, we have verse 21:4, wherein death is indeed cast out alongside hell following God's final judgment and the rapture, because there is no more need for him. Although there does seem to be some confusion then with the souls that aren't taken into heaven and the next life, whether they are condemned to it says in multiple places, eternal death or eternal life, being burnt alive in the hellish lake of fire. Either way, though, we either have eternal death, which never changes, so death doesn't need to bring it, or eternal life of being burnt alive that also never ends, so death doesn't need to come in and end it. Of course, we do see death all alone, hanging out by himself at the end of time in, I think it's Eric, though he doesn't seem too bothered by the whole affair. So yes, perhaps his motivations in Thief of Time are more selfless than those of self-preservation. Moving on to a more scientific approach to the philosophy of time now, we return to the science of Discworld 3, wherein Stewart and Cohen discuss the types of time paradoxes that Pratchett presents in both Thief of Time and Pyramids in terms of the quantum theories forwarded by British physicist Julian Barbour in his 1999 book, The End of Time. And Barbour's been brought up before in relation to Discworld because, as Stewart and Cohen note in the first Science of Discworld book, in Barbour's view, the real laws of physics specify a static universe of timeless nows, wherein the apparent flow of time is an illusion created because the collection of nows that corresponds to a human being that makes them experience its world as if it were an ordered series of events happening one after the other, and that apparent gaps of duration between successive events are merely blanks where no now exists. And that through quantum, Pratchett's favorite solution and explanation for everything, these simultaneously existing nows collapse into an apparently linear history, which is all to say that it hasn't actually taken me 4 months to get an episode out about Thief of Time, right? None of this ever existed until all of a sudden it did all at once, but only for me, or you, one of us. I don't know if Barbour allows for multiple people to perceive or experience the same instances. But Stewart and Cohen explore Barbour's theories further in The Science of Discworld 3, which is coincidentally called Darwin's Watch, again alluding to timepieces and things. But in that book, Stewart and Cohen claim to discredit Barbour's theories using the concept of temporal momentum and a snakes and ladders analogy that just makes everything even more confusing, I think. So I don't really want to delve into that here. And again, as with the history of time travel literature stuff, I would just be rehashing what they'd said, so you can go and read that section of The Science of Discworld 3 in your own time. Nevertheless, as Stewart and Cohen observe, Thief of Time explores some remarkably similar issues to Barbour from the Discworld viewpoint. Towards the beginning of the book, we are told that the reason Wen is eternally surprised is because he understood that the universe is instant by instant recreated anew. Therefore, he understood there is, in truth, no past, only a memory of the past. Blink your eyes, and the world you see next did not exist when you closed them, and that therefore, the only appropriate state of the mind is surprise. So yeah, here Pratchett does reference this idea of the universe being recreated anew in each instant, and it is also reliant on the observer in a quantum sense. But I took this more to say that once each moment has passed, the past is but a memory. It's not that it never existed, it's that it no longer exists, and that the moment you are living in is a new moment, but not necessarily one with an illusory history or a disconnected history. So I don't know if that's quite as connected to Barbour's theories as it first appears, even though it is borrowing the same sort of language and worldview, this continuous and instantaneous recreation. But yeah, Wen's philosophy, as I read it, relies on linearity, envisioning existence as a succession of instants, even though only one exists at a time. And I think it can therefore be more accurately related to that other influential 1990s philosopher, Garth Algar, who reminds us to
live in the now!
So all of this time stuff had me digging out my identity theory textbooks again, because it reminded me that a prominent theory of personal identity is the four-dimensionalist theory, which posits that personal identity is a four-dimensional construct that exists over time. And this is a theory that is most influentially forwarded by the American philosopher David Lewis, who contends in his 1976 essay Survival and Identity that persons are maximal are interrelated aggregates of persons and stages, because philosophers be like that sometimes. He does explain this a bit more clearly in the article itself, though, saying that those who say that what matters in survival, because this is, when talking about identity theory, there's this idea of does identity survive from one stage of a person's life to another, i.e. is the me now the same as the me in 20 years or 20 years ago, or, you know, months ago when I started researching and recording the first part of the Thief of Time episode. But he says that those who say that what matters in survival is a relation of mental continuity and connectedness, are speaking of a relation among more or less momentary person stages or time slices of continuate persons or persons at times. I don't know why they say persons rather than people. It seems to be a identity theory and lawyer thing. But yeah, there he's saying that if the idea that even though my physical body and even my brain neurons and things may have changed and replaced, you know, in 20 years' time or whatever, this is the thing about your body replacing all its cells and the ship of Theseus, dyslexia stuff, that if you replace all the parts of the person, are they still the same person? And often the response is, well, it's a mental continuity. If you can remember things, and then that comes into problems of, well, you can't remember everything, and memories can be made up and all of that. But he says that if what's important is this idea of continuity and connectedness, then identity is a relation between different individual stages. But he's sort of refuting this idea, even though he's proposing a very similar one, because he's saying that in this case, there is no continuous person. Identity is not an object, it's a relation. That there is a distinct person, me now, a distinct person, me months ago when I recorded the first part of the Thief of Time episode, and that these people have a relationship between each other that is called identity, that we are connected by memories and other things, but that we constitute distinctly individual instances of a person. He says, conversely, although it does sound very similar, that those who say that what matters in survival is identity, on the other hand, must be speaking of identity among temporally extended continuant persons with stages at various times, and that what matters is that one and the same continuant person should have stages both now and later, and that it's not about, you know, the survival, the continuity of this one individual person at one stage to still exist at some other stage in the future, that it is about looking at the whole. So that a person, rather being a three-dimensional object, a point in time, is a four-dimensional object. They talk about people as tubes or strings or whatever, right? It's this four-dimensional, that the person is not these little instances that somehow continue, or that the way that they continue is that the thing that is the person is not the instance, it's the relationship, it's the continuation, then taken as a whole to become an object. It seems a little semantic here. It sounds like these positions are sort of saying the same thing and applying different labels. But Lewis argues that identity among stages has nothing to do with it, since stages are momentary. That even if you survive, your present stage is not identical to any future stage. An illustrative example of this is the transporters from Star Trek. Identity... philosophers love to bring up Star Trek. That's an actual thing. Obviously, Star Trek is representing a lot of these philosophical ideas that then is a bit of a feedback loop that then Star Trek becomes the go-to thing for philosophers to explain or illustrate a lot of these ideas. But this is like the transporters in Star Trek, which it's like the TV in Willy Wonka, that they atomize you, they break you down into all your constituent parts, and then reassemble you in the new location. So by definition, your body and even your mind, if we want to equate the mind, if we want to take a physicalist approach to this and say that, well, there isn't a soul, or if there is, the metaphysical part of a human is contained within the brain, there's just neurons and things firing, which is itself an identity theory. That, yeah, it breaks you down. So physically, you don't exist anymore, and then you're rebuilt in a new location. And even in that instance, rather than just the me sitting here now that is not technically the same as the me sitting here 10 minutes ago or whatever, but there is a continuation of momentum, like in the quantum universe stuff that I was talking about before. In the teleporter instance, the transporter instance, there is a break in the continuity. I mean, unless you, I think different Star Treks have different mechanics and things, I'm not entirely sure, but like the Willy Wonka example, right, your atoms are literally, you get broken down, but it is the same atoms that are being beamed through the air and then reconstituted in the new location on the other side of the room. In Star Trek, you are broken down into a computer program, into a pattern. You are scanned, disintegrated, and then rebuilt based on that data. So there is a break in continuity. That old you does not connect to the new you, and the new you is being rebuilt. And then identity theorists would say that what is important is not the physical continuity, but the continuity of memory. But then there's a whole thing, are they false memories that have just been created by a computer program? Are we in the Matrix, etc., etc.? Anyway, Lewis writes that even if you survive, your present stage is not identical to any future stage. Weirdly, he does throw in a footnote here, again, because philosophers be like this sometimes. He says, unless, of course, time is circular, so that your future stage is in its own future in the same way that places on a globe are technically to the west of themselves. But he also says that possibly also has nothing to do with survival. He says, you know that your present stage will not survive the battle or the teleporting or whatever, I'm not sure what battle, but that this is not disconcerting because you know that you will survive, right? Your identity will survive even if your current self will not. But yes, at the end of all this, we get an idea of a person as a string or a tube or like a worm that is extended in time. And find that each instance is what these philosophers call a time slice. So that if you took the sausage or the worm, I'll try to avoid the meat and animal cruelty stuff here. If you took the tube, the cylinder of Play-Doh or whatever, or cookie dough, and you cut it, right, you did a cross section, that cross section, that time slice, is the you at any given instant, which of course can be infinitely divided up into its own instances, but that you as a person and as identity is the entire tube itself. I mean, the analogy Lewis uses is of a train car, where he says trains are maximal aggregates of cars interrelated by the relation of being coupled together, which is to say that, yeah, the train, that you pull apart and rearrange the carriages and you call it the same train, but bits and pieces of it are not connected in time. I don't know if that is a great analogy because the train is identity is sort of determined by the locomotive. Maybe more on this when we get to Raising Steam, maybe. But yeah, it's more of a chain, a link to envision yourself, not as one continuous person, but as lots of individual links all connected together, neither of which individually is a chain. No link in the chain is a chain, but all together they make up the chain. And he's saying, you are the chain, you are not the link. But I do think it is interesting that this theory that is built around individual moments of time adding up to that these individual moments that they call time slices, that's sort of the general term that's used in a lot of this theory. Lewis himself, I think, actually prefers person stages, but these time slices, these cross sections of people all adding up into one person. Yeah, it's interesting that this whole identity theory is based on this idea of time slices and then sort of connects and applies to a book where the protagonists are often slicing time. That's just word association there. But ontological philosophy of when that is based on this sort of quantum collapsing and re-emerging that are related to both Taoism, but also the Julian Barber's idea of quantum physics and things, that this same sort of idea exists in identity theory. It's not just that time, whether you believe in Wen or Barber or whoever, this idea that time is instantaneous, that moments disintegrate and reappear, or that each new time is distinct from the last because it now has a new temporal value, and that time, and then Stuart and Cohen step in and say that yes, but what connects them is this momentum. That same sort of idea is very much present in the identity theory stuff, in that no instant of you is identical, but you make up a singular identity through the temporal momentum of all these instances being connected together. And this relates to ideas of identity fusion and fission, in that, well, if you cut your cookie dough in half, you now have two cookie doughs that are identical to the original cookie dough roll, but not identical to each other because they're not connected temporarily. Or if you had two cookie dough slices that you then mush together into one cookie dough slice, that would be personally identical with both because it is connected, right? And that's what we see happen with Lobsang and Jeremy at the end of Thief of Time, that Lobsang is not Jeremy before they are fused. It's not even an instance of one identity being split because the whole idea is that they are born twice, right? It's in the same instant, even though metaphysically they are the same person, but they are not temporarily connected. When I say temporarily, I mean temporarily, not briefly. But yeah, ironically, Lobsang and Jeremy have never been connected in time until they fuse at the end of the book. So even though they are the same person, by Lewis's rationality, they don't have the same identity. But the combined Lobsang at the end of the book is identical to both the original uncombined Lobsang and Jeremy. If that makes any sense. I don't know why I went with the cookie dough analogy rather than the train one. I don't even really like cookies, nor do I bake them from dough blocks, but there you go. So that is the idea of time as an abstract, almost detached concept. But Thief of Time is also concerned with how humans and other creatures experience time through its engagement with the idea of history via the history monks and things. And as Butler observes in his Pocket Essentials review, in addition to all the metaphysics, there is also the sense of historical process in Thief of Time, which has been apparent over the previous two or three Discworld novels, which would have been The Truth, The Fifth Elephant, and Carpet Jugulum. And Butler says, now with Klax's collaborative commerce and the printing press, there is the sense that the city of Ankh-Morpork has progressed from a medieval to Renaissance to industrial 19th century conturbation, which is a fancy word for arrangement. And of course, Butler is writing this straight after Thief of Time has come out, right? This is the last book that he reviews there. So he doesn't know where the rest of the series goes. But yes, from Thief of Time, just a bit over halfway through the series, through the rest of it, we are focused on this industrial revolution and with a greater focus on the machinations and politics of Ankh-Morpork as it becomes a more modernized distinctly Victorian city as opposed to the more medieval one we're presented with in The Colour of Magic and the other early Discworld books, which is to say that Thief of Time as the final book in the death sequence is quite fitting in that it signals the last of the more magical Discworld novels, I think, before the focus shifts towards the Industrial Revolution and the Watch across the rest of the series, with, you know, more of the magical stuff largely relegated to the Tiffany Aching novels, which are, you know, sort of seen as separate from the primary continuity. Right, we do get The Truth immediately one book before, so in a sense that is the watershed moment. I mean, for me, just through my personal experience, this succession of moments that I remember existing in this quantum instant, I read The Truth immediately after reading Thief of Time. That was the next one I'd read. So in my head, I always think The Truth comes after Thief of Time in the sequence, but it doesn't. The Truth is first. But I think in many ways, it makes a lot of sense to sort of flip that Thief of Time is the last of the traditional sort of high fantasy Discworld novels that's dealing with metaphysics and cosmic concepts and time manipulation and horsemen and things, before we settle into an almost more low fantasy mode for a lot of the rest of the series that is dealing with the day-to-day life of the quote-unquote average characters within the municipality of Ankh-Morpork. And in conjunction with this shift towards the Industrial Revolution, we also have Thief of Time being a pivotal novel in the mechanical creation of the Discworld itself, because it was during the writing of Thief of Time that Rob Wilkins became Pratchett's personal assistant. And as he recalls in the Life with Footnotes biography, Wilkins recalls being at the keyboard taking letters by dictation during his early tenure, when Pratchett suddenly told him to open a new file and got him to take down some paragraphs intended for Thief of Time instead. And he says that Pratchett then chose to write that way more and more until within a couple of months it had become his dominant method, and thus did Thief of Time and every other Discworld novel up until Unseen Academicals in 2011, so 10 years later, get written till it is taken over by the dictation software that was brought in to compensate for Pratchett's Alzheimer's. I'm not really sure why Pratchett didn't continue to dictate to Wilkins in that situation. It seems like it would have become more reliant on Wilkins, and maybe he did, and I'm misinterpreting that as the dictation to Wilkins continued, but rather than writing independently, it then became a combination of the dictation software and the Wilkins dictation rather than Pratchett's individual writing and the Wilkins dictation. But either way, as well as a thematic shift, we also have a historical, cultural, materialist intervention in the production of the Discworld in terms of shifting technologies, which is then reflected in the text. Thief of Time is also, of course, the last book to feature cover art by Josh Kirby, passed away later that year, with the artwork for The Amazing Maurice and The Last Hero being taken care of courtesy of his successor, Paul Kidby. So, yeah, Thief of Time, very much a watershed novel for Pratchett that signals the end of not the early, I think we can make a division at Small Gods perhaps there, but the first half of the Discworld series that is more concerned with traditional fantasy before it gets more into becomes more of a sociologically first series that is reflected both its cover art and its literal construction. Now, the shift in writing methods and technologies, as well as the greater focus on the Industrial Revolution within Discworld, is also interesting in terms of Thief of Time, because the real world, the round world, Industrial Revolution and technological progression is intricately tied in with the concept of time and the shifts in its perceptions. So if you'll bear with me here, I do want to give a very broad and truncated overview of the history of clockmaking and how that has influenced our understanding of time itself, which is quite a lofty and intimidating task, which may explain why I've put off recording this episode for so long. But according to Samuel Macy in his 1987 book, Patriarchs of Time, Dualism in Saturn Kronos, Father Time, the Watchmaker God, and Father Christmas, which I spoke about a lot in one of the Hogfather episodes, and really seems quite pertinent to the entire death cycle as a whole. But as Macy explains, in the 1300s, when sundials still dominated the working day, the days and the nights were each divided equally into 12 parts, and that these unequal or temporal hours were more than twice as long on summer days than they were on winter days, right? That's just with sundials and things. You're recording daylight or representing daylight rather than the actual period or periods that are passing. And Macy, so the entire concept of clocks and hours which are being used are not seen as precise, right? They're more indicators, and they are tied to a subjective experience rather than an objective record. And it's not until the late 1500s, so, you know, almost 200 years later, that equal objective hours began being used, and then it's not for another half century or so that relatively accurate clocks are first invented in 1657 by the Dutch astronomer Christian Huygens, with the later invention of pendulum clocks further demonstrating how the length of the supposed 24-hour day, as measured by sundials, varied as much as 32 minutes through the course of the year. And the emphasis on accurate timekeeping in the 1600s also led to things like the Newtonian notion of the clockwork universe and the watchmaker god. This is the reference to Darwin's watch that is used as the subtitle to the third Science of Discworld novel. I'll maybe talk more about that there if I end up doing the Science of Discworld books. But the interpretation of God as a watchmaker meant that, and the incorporation of Newtonian physics meant that motion was always upon the decay, this idea that God wound up the universe as a clock once, and that everything was slowly decaying by way of entropy, right? We return to this idea of order and chaos. But this also fits in with the current scientific view of the Big Bang, which is a ballistic one, right? The idea is that the universe will eventually wind down to a very order-friendly state of stasis. Yes, but returning to our history of time now, which again relies on Macy, so I'm taking this at face value, even though maybe I shouldn't, but he seems pretty reliable otherwise. But he says that in the early 1800s, the Danish antiquarian C.J. Thompson developed the three-age system of archaeological classification, which divided human prehistory into technologically progressive stone, bronze, and iron ages. This whole idea of prehistory itself relies on a technological distinction, right? That prehistory in an archaeological sense means pre-recorded history, which is pre-literary, right? Because we don't have oral records. So yeah, there is a logocentric ideology at play in this system. But it also stands in contrast to classic mythologies, which conceived of humanity's deterioration from a utopian golden age through diminished silver, bronze, and iron ages, the last being the current one, wherein men apparently live in toil and misery. This is the idea of labor as the meaning of life that Pratchett and Death seem so bent on. This is also connected with conceptions of vegetarianism, where in the classical mythologies and pre-1800 or pre-1900 romantic interpretations of the Bible and Genesis, right, humanity begins as pure and vegetarian and deteriorates through corruption and meat-eating into a more violent and sinful existence, which is then inverted in the later 18th and 19th centuries through the idea of evolution and the hunting hypothesis and survival of the fittest, in that humans are then empowered through meat-eating, which is enabled by tool-making, to rise above other animals, which is what we get in Hogfather, which is to say that ideology matters. This is Nadav's keyhole thing. The Iron Age means different things depending on how you look at it and what is valued, right? If work and hunting are valued, then the Iron Age is empowering. But if work and hunting are disavowed and things to be avoided, then the Iron Age is a deterioration. Again, Stewart and Cohen make similar connections when discussing Thief of Time, this time in The Science of Discworld 2, pointing out that until the idea of progress became fully accepted, men had thought of their ancestors as giants and themselves as pygmies. Stewart and Cohen also note that while Egyptian, Babylonian, Indian, Chinese, and Greek religions and mythologies all emphasize cycles, Abrahamic ones tend to be more linear. I'm not entirely sure about this because the Egyptian concept of the afterlife tends to be pretty similar, I would have thought. Maybe there's a touch of reincarnation there. More on this when I look at pyramids, perhaps. But either way, Macy also points out how many Indo-Iranian pantheons' most important deities are gods of time, among whom there are several twin gods who represent infinite and finite time, which is what we get in Jeremy and Lobsang, right? Their merger at the end of the book is the merger of the infinite and the finite. We've got into philosophy again. Returning to the historical aspect, Macy also claims that concurrent with the invention of modern clocks was a shift in the definition of the word progress, which began to be more popularly applied to time rather than space. So having consulted the almighty OED, we get our third definition of progress as a verb to move forward in time, to go on, to proceed, advance, or to carry on, to follow an expected course or path, which is the earliest temporal definition, which dates to 1600. So this backs up what Macy is saying. Although earlier spatial definitions of progress as to go or move forward or onward in space, only date back to 1579, and the earliest noun usage as the course or process of a series of actions, sequence, or events, or a period of time, dates back well before that to 1443. So I'm not sure how significant a language shift there is there, and maybe this is another example of Macy's slightly sloppy scholarship. But you do see this reflected in late 18th century Western perceptions of time, which begin to move with the emphasis on progress also leading to things like social Darwinism and Marxism, which is then reflected in the move towards more organic rather than mechanical models of time, and then in response to evolution and evolutionary theory. So that by the 19th century, Macy writes, railways and their telegraphs were demonstrating the differences in local time, so that in 1884, time zones were instituted. And of course, the mainline Discworld series, if we're not counting the Shepherd's Crown, which is part of the Young Reader series, though I would, but again, the way they were marketed, ends with Raising Steam, which is about the institution of railways. And if we have the telegraphs, or the Klax system, being implemented in Thief of Time itself. So it seems like the influence of accurate clockmaking on the real world is largely incidentally, but very prominently reflected in the progression of the Discworld series itself. Also, something really interesting I learned while doing all this is I finally learned why a second's called a second. It's because it's a second minute, right? If a minute is something divided into 60, you have the hour divided into 60, and then all the minutes divided into second minutes. Or secondary minutes, which makes a lot of sense, but it's not something I'd been wondering, but it's something I had never thought about my whole life that I came across when reading this and thought, huh, that is an interesting and rather foundational concept. And just to bring things to a close, Macy says that in 1967, the temporal accuracy of our solar system was quietly but firmly questioned when the second itself was divorced from the mean day and related instead to the vibration of the cesium-133 atom. This is the atomic clock. So now the idea of time has nothing to do with the sun, which was a subjective relative measure. So I guess under this new paradigm, if you stopped the sun from coming up, time itself would not stop, although imagination might. But somewhere this shift from a spatial concept of progress to a temporal one is seen distinctly is in science fiction literature, particularly of the utopian variety. If we think about Thomas More's Utopia itself, right, it's an island, and other classic examples such as Bacon's New Atlantis and things, these were islands that sailors would discover and be like, oh, there's this amazing, perfect civilization over there. We should be more like them, even though they're both being satirical, whatever. But that was because, you know, not everything had been mapped. So if you wanted to find something new, you could just go off the map and, oh, we found something new over here. By the 1800s, though, most of the world has been mapped. Utopians and science fiction writers then need to find a new place to set their, you know, alternative societies and things, which one way to do that is to go off into space at different planets and different dimensions and things. But another way to do that is to simply set it in the future, right? We've now moved from a spatial extrapolation to a temporal one. And you see this in the foundation of modern science fiction in that in the late 1700s, we have Gulliver's Travels, which is about going to these islands and things. And then we get which is seen as, you know, a pretty significant work of prototypical modern science fiction. And then we get the establishment of the modern science fiction tradition through Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, which is set in the past and draws on classic Lapsarian mythology. But then after that, Shelley writes The Last Man, which is set in the future and predicts a future utopia and collapse. And then what I believe is the third science fiction novel is Jane Loudon's The Mummy, which is essentially a ripoff of The Last Man, starring a ripoff of Frankenstein or The Creature. More about that when I talk about pyramids. But yeah, the Shelleyan intervention is, as well as the scientific extrapolation, which was already present in Gulliver's Travels, is we get a temporal extrapolation as well. And this is again reflected in the contrast between the next two most significant science fiction writers being Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. With Jules Verne, you get these spatial shifts. His two most well-known books are being The Journey to the Center of the Earth and 20,000 Leagues Below the Sea. So he's going into the earth and into the sea to these unexplored regions. And also he has island novels and things, The Mysterious Island. Whereas in contrast, Wells's first novel is the time machine, which takes us forward in time and then all the way through to the end of time and things. And you see that reflected in the utopian literature of the time as well, with Bellamy's Looking Backward and Morris's News from Nowhere. And I think we see a similar progression in Discworld as well. And it's perhaps a transition from more of a fantastic to more of a science fictional mode as well. But the series begins with the travel narratives of The Color of Magic, The Light Fantastic, Witches Abroad, where the characters are going off and visiting all these different places, pyramids as well. And that stays fairly consistent all the way up until The Last Continent and Interesting Times. I think are the last two major examples of this. I guess you have things like Monstrous Regiment, where they're going off in and visiting different countries later on, and Snuff as well. But those are done within the context of this Industrial Revolution thing. The last, like, purely sort of fantastic travel narratives, where they visit the Counterweight Continent, where they visit 4X, which is, of course, the Australia analogue, which is also interesting, and I think this is coincidental, but going back to the utopian map thing, Australia was one of the last places that was used as a setting for spatial utopias up until the early 1900s. Before the form sort of died out or was incorporated into science fiction via Wells. That's a whole other thing that I've written a thesis about. But yeah, the last sort of stand of utopian spatial literature, a lot of them are set sort of in the center of Australia. There was this idea that there was some kind of tropical paradise at the center of Australia, because that was the last place that people, or the British Empire, hadn't visited, hadn't mapped out. So it's interesting that that is sort of where Pratchett winds up as his last travel narrative as well, though in The Last Continent we also get some time travel stuff as well. And Clockwork also has a significant role to play in the formation of science fiction, because Hoffman's Sandman, which is a German text rather than an English one, but is very similar to Shelley's Frankenstein, and I find it kind of hard to argue that Frankenstein did anything significantly original that Sandman was not. For people unfamiliar with this story, this is about a mad scientist who builds a robotic clockwork automata for a daughter. It's a short story rather than a novel, right? It's not as elaborated as Frankenstein or anything, but it's sort of doing the same thing that Mary Shelley did a couple of years earlier with Clockwork. And then clocks are also really rather prominent throughout the work of Edgar Allan Poe, who Brian Aldiss, I think, says is the next significant science fiction writer after Mary Shelley. How much of Poe's stuff I would personally classify as science fiction is debatable, but there's no denying that he is an aesthetic and stylistic influence, at least. And of course, he has such famous stories as The Pendulum and The Pit. In checking Eric, or the scene with Death at the end of time for all the time stuff I'm doing here, I am also reminded that Death has a big pendulum clock in his hall, which has the interminable task of slicing time into manageable bits. And although it never really jumped out to me, like I didn't remember it was there, but this seems to be a bit of a fixture of the Death Discworld novels, being first mentioned in Mort, and then again in Reaper Man, where Pratchett writes, "In the hall of the House of Death is a clock with a pendulum like a blade, but with no hands, because in the House of Death there is no time but the present. There was, of course, a present before the present now, but that was also the present, it was just an older one. And that the pendulum is a blade that would have made Edgar Allan Poe give it all up and start again as a stand-up comedian. And that in Soul Music, we find out that in addition to having no hands, the pendulum on the clock also has a scythe blade, which, quote the Raven remarks, is a nice touch, very gothic." So a bit of that tradition leaking into Pratchett there as well. So continuing on with the history theme here, there is a 2003 article called Popular Theory, where an author, Alan McKee, compares Pratchett's engagement with history and culture in Thief of Time with that of Mags L. Halliday's 2002 Doctor Who novel History 101 and Jasper Ford's 2001 Bronte crime pastiche The Air Affair, neither of which I have read. I did attempt to read the Doctor Who book, which McKee is very favourable towards and makes sounds very interesting in his article. But yeah, not being a Doctor Who fan and not really having watched much of the TV series, it was quite a shock to jump into the Doctor Who tone. Both the Doctor Who universe with all its characters and mechanics and plot threads that I have no reference for and don't understand, but also just the tone of the whole thing, I don't think was really sitting well with me. So I abandoned that fairly quickly. And I didn't attempt to read the Jasper Ford novel. Jasper Ford is a writer who I'm aware of, but not particularly familiar with. They have a few books of theirs that I am interested to read at some stage, particularly Shades Grey, not of the 50 variety in the Ha Ha books several here. Although this did come out a year after that, so it does seem to be a bit of a strange and perhaps unwise title-y choice there. No, that book is about a dystopian world where class is determined by the ability to see colour and things. Sounds cool, sounds interesting. But The Air Affair, which is, I think, Ford's first book and perhaps his most well-known, and it's the first in a big long series that I am intimidated by and also don't really want to delve into this stage at least. But this is a metafictional detective novel where, as far as I understand it, there is a detective who, where a detective chases a criminal literally like into the book Jane Eyre, although I think it's an alternative history version of Jane Eyre or something. But yeah, this detective, she pursues a criminal through a book, and I think that's how the series works, which is a cool idea and is probably quite good. I hate Jane Eyre. I really don't care for Jane Eyre at all. I think it has a lot to answer for in terms of, speaking of 50 Shades Grey, the idealization of abusive men a la Twilight and such. So no real interest in that, but it is quite a well-known and well-respected book as far as I am aware. And yes, McKee is quite positive about his engagement about the Doctor Who novel, which he spends most of the article discussing. But he does conclude that it is Pratchett, out of this collection of books, whose ideas are most attractive and useful due to his consistent and insistent use of bathos to bring questions of sense-making and culture back to the everyday world of chocolate and salad crate sandwiches, even if Pratchett's intellectual work is less abstract and less nuanced than Halliday. And it is Pratchett who insists that it is the everyday practice of sense-making that makes humanity worth defending, not just the artistic creations of dead white males. Oh yeah, but this Doctor Who book, again, I haven't read it, but it seems to be about going back in time and looking at art history and things. I think that dead white males line is perhaps not fully thought through, given that Charlotte Bronte, the author of Jane Eyre, is of course female, was considered quite radical for her time. It does seem to be an undergraduate article or early postgraduate article even, so I suspect the author was perhaps earlier in their career, and it is the arguments are largely based around this nebulous and never properly defined idea of intellectual work, whatever that means. But there is an interesting idea and comparison going on here. There is this idea of, you know, culture versus everyday human experience, which I do think flies in the face of the article somewhat, given its emphasis on intellectual work and things like that. But what it points out about Thief Time is that the gallery scenes at the end with the fights with the auditor, like, there's a reason why it is set in an art gallery, and that Pratchett is lampooning this idea of, you know, humanity is great because of its art, because of the things it produces, history and culture and things. And yeah, as much as I personally don't really connect with the chocolate device during these scenes, I do think there's a bit of an unfortunate sexism angle there. Like, it would be nice if, you know, maybe Lobsang or Ronnie or someone male came in and was also into the chocolate. But the idea of humanity is not these cultural, big C, capital C, high cultural artifacts and things. It is the everyday experiences, the sensuousness of the physical body, and also, you know, the friendship and human connections that we see illustrated in those scenes through the developing relationship between Susan and Lady Jean, and also sensuousness, sense-making in terms of the auditors not being able to decode the paradoxes and things, which again is a very Star Trek idea, trope of Captain Kirk doing sort of logical jujitsu against a lot of the hyper-intelligent computers and things. And McKee writes that it's true that we see the auditors attempt to understand a painting by reducing it to its component molecules when looking for its elusive meaning, as we might in any typical science fiction gambit. I might add, of course, previously in Hogfather as well. He points out that what finally defeats these truthful, non-conscious creatures is the consumption of crimped chocolates. That for Pratchett, it is sense-making culture that makes us distinct as a species, with Susan coming to the conclusion that the human soul without the anchor of the body would end up eventually as something like an auditor, which I think again points back to Pratchett as a physicalist, even though there's a distinctive dualist metaphysics going on in the Discworld of the Souls and things. The understanding and ideology of humanity that he is, if not actively promoting, embedding in these books. No, I'm going to say actively promoting. You have Susan making statements like that. But this is a very physicalist idea of you are your body, and that's okay. And there is an implication with the art gallery stuff as well, that this so-called great art, which is valued, which is impressive and is important, but comes from the same sort of experiences as the chocolate, right? You can't break down a Van Gogh painting or something into its constituent parts and have it have the same effect. It is the physical sensation of experiencing it through your eyes. That is what is so impressive about it. It is more than the sum of its parts, so to speak. It is through the manipulation of the senses rather than the intellect that this great visual art is produced. I mean, you can dissect art in the same way that I am dissecting Pratchett at great length and with many tangents. And I remember, like, I saw there's the Salvador Dali painting of Jesus. I don't know what it's called, but I saw that in a gallery once. I think it was German or something. I don't remember which country. Somewhere in Europe. But I saw this painting and I was struck by it. Like, it had a very sensual, and I mean that not a sexy way, not that there's a very sexy shirtless carpenter being depicted, but that it was like a physical reaction to this painting that is what made it literally impressive to me. And you know, they had little diagrams and things next to this painting that was pointing out how it was constructed and the lines and that it's all based around triangles and things. So Dali is obviously intellectually aware and breaking these things down, but it is the actual effect of the art isn't because of that. I didn't have to look at it and think about the triangles to go, it's cool. Like, you know, maybe that makes it better. And that's why I do this literary analysis stuff, because I find this enhances the art for me or enhances my experience and understanding of the world through the art. But yeah, it was just the striking confrontation with the Dali painting itself that was so impressive and valuable. And, you know, I ranted about the snubbing of Pratchett for the Booker Prize and things in the first episode, but there's something to that about, you know, popular literature and quote unquote literary literature, intellectual literature, that as much as like I loathe something like Twilight or 50 Shades of Grey to sort of keep it on point, you know, that there is something about these books that makes them popular. Maybe it's a cultural materialism thing, maybe it has to do with marketing and things like that, but there is something appealing about these works that when I pour through Twilight trying to work out what about this from an intellectual level is appealing and I can't find it, it's because it's not there. Adding to that, McKee also writes that the process of making sense of events is necessarily a subjective one. It is seeing only part of the world. Just as the absolute must master the art of forgetting, so the auditors must learn to ignore parts of the world in order to make sense of it. Which brings us back to the Darth's keyhole thing from Hogfather. Not only are you not seeing the whole of a thing when you look at the world or analyze a piece of art, but also contained within that whole, within that vision through the keyhole is everything that you're bringing to it. I don't know if I've done a good job of representing this article here, but that is what I took away from it. That is the keyhole I saw through. So I noted in the discussion on the history of time and things, the tendency in a Western world, at least, to think of time as linear and to progress towards entropic stasis, and that this is reflected in the literary science fiction tradition through works like Shelley's Last Man, wherein all humanity's progress leads to is eventually eliminated and returns to stasis, and also in Wells's Time Machine, where the time traveler travels through to, well, if not the end of time, the end of humanity, where there has been an evolutionary regression, which is something Pratchett parodies in the first Science of Discworld novel. And I bring this up because in the Pocket Essential Guide, Butler also likens some of the ideas about culture and progress in Thief of Time to the American political scientist Francis Fukuyama's notion of the end of history, which he published an essay on in 1989, and which Butler points out is rather ironically a very 1980s idea, which had perhaps long passed its sell-by date over a decade later when Pratchett was writing Thief of Time. But I do think this idea reverberates throughout the 1990s and is the culmination of a lot of 20th century philosophy that's based in thinkers like Hegel and perhaps more pertinently Karl Marx's ideas about the linear progression of history. So this Fukushima's idea is that liberal democracy as practiced in America and by now the wider Western world and things represented an end point of political evolution, but he was framing it against connotations of the word progress. It's not just one thing led to another, it's one thing led to something better. It's a touch of social Darwinism in that not everything or everything that has evolved equal, right? Everything that exists now is equally suited to its part or has been equally successful or maintained because it has been successful at surviving. But then there is, people take that to mean that what is now is necessarily better than what came before, that things that can dominate something else are more highly evolved and such. And Fukushima is making that claim about liberal democracy. And remember, he's writing this in 1989, so this is following the collapse of the USSR and the fall of the Berlin War and the perceived defeat of communism and such. So as Butler points out, very, very zeitgeisty, right? Maybe could have used a bit of hindsight on this one in 2020 and whatnot. Not necessarily an idea that has stood the test of time, to keep things on theme. But yeah, connecting this back to my ramblings about social Darwinism and things, I don't want to go into too much detail about this article because it is sort of outdated and not particularly relevant to Thief of Time. But yeah, going back to my ramblings about social Darwinism and things, although Fukuyama is influenced by Marx, he doesn't treat this so much the fall of of communism and the rise of liberal democracy as a materialist and contextual event. He makes several arguments about being a result of human nature, arguments toward this being the natural state that humans strive for, which, yeah, again, he's an American political scientist writing this in 1989. I don't know if you can quite see the forest for the trees on this one. It also brings up one of the many problems I have with arguments from nature, being that, you know, if something is natural, it is therefore good, it is therefore better, much like the evolution thing. I resist this because either everything's natural or nothing is, right? You know, humans build houses and have smartphones in their pockets, and that's natural because that's what humans do. That's what we've evolved and done naturally. So to say something is natural, like anything we do is natural, anything we've done, we've evolved to do it. So it's sort of a pointless categorization. Obviously, that is not the way it is used in such arguments. There's a distinction between nature as removed from humanity. But even to accept this idea of human nature and things, to me, that's always been whatever's natural is the lowest common denominator, right? It is the baseline. So even to accept Fukuyama's argument that liberal democracy is a natural human urge or whatever, it's like, okay, but that is a starting point. Then how do we improve upon liberal democracy rather than liberal democracy being the endpoint to strive for, that once we achieve it, then everything must be good because it has been achieved, that it is natural? I don't know. Maybe I'm getting into my own things about defying human nature and not accepting myself as part of nature and things like that. But yeah, this idea is rather prominent during what the comedian Greg Proops would call the peace and prosperity scare of the 1990s, which is not to say there weren't international conflicts, particularly with America and the First Gulf War and such. But it did signal the end of an era, of the end of the Cold War, which is itself an extension of the Second World War. Like, there'd been half a century of global conflict that, if not entirely resolved, had certainly dissipated around the end of the 1980s when Fukuyama is writing this. And I can see how that world view can carry through, and I was there for it. I was a child. I can see how that idea has appeal and perhaps some kind of empirical basis from the keyhole of westernized American-dominated culture that would carry through to the time when Pratchett, who's lived through this and been at the height of his powers through the 1990s, that when he is coming to write The Time, it's in 2001, at the end of this era, that there is perhaps some ideas carrying through, reverberating through just by basis of the culture that he is coming from. Of course, though, the big thing and the big test that sort of puts the lie to Fukuyama's theory is September 11th, which happens about 3.5 months after Thief of Time is first published, so it is not even available in paperback. And yeah, none of this is really embedded in the text itself, but whatever thematic resonances Butler and perhaps other readers are picking up on there are immediately obsolete upon Thief of Time's publication. You know, it might seem a bit silly to talk about the floating turtle world in terms of 9/11, and Pratchett is, of course, a British author, so it is perhaps less significant for him than a lot of the American authors and things, but I'm Australian, and 9/11 certainly had an impact on the world I live in and the media I consume, and of course the following war on terror was something that Britain and Australia were heavily involved in as allies of the US. And 9/11 is, as well as being, you know, the most significant world event of my lifetime and just changing politics and culture in the broader sense, has a very specific significance for postmodernist literature, which Pratchett, of course, falls into, even if he is at fringe parody fantasy side of it. But there is a lot of literary theory and theorists that I won't go into here that contend that 9/11 is the end of postmodernism. It's an end of naivety and innocence, but also the playfulness of postmodern literature and the self-importance of postmodernist literature. And you see a lot of the major, mostly American postmodernist figures, the literature and other art they produce after 9/11 is response to it. And Pratchett never goes that far, but there is perhaps something there, if not a direct response, just a response to the way the world has changed, rather than the instance of 9/11 itself. But it is interesting that along with this focus on a 19th century style industrial revolution, the other thread that comes to dominate the later Discworld novels outside of the Tiffany Aching books, the mainline ones, is the dominance of the Watch, who also play a significant role in the Industrial Revolution books as well, and we'll get to it when I finally get to those books in 16 years. But there is a lot of police brutality and, you know, 24-style justifications for torture and disobeying protocol and conventions and things which, you know, comes from earlier stuff like Dirty Harry and Lethal Weapon and things, but I think it takes on a much different implication and connotation following 9/11, and it is interesting and perhaps not coincidental that the one follow-on that we get from this from Thief of Time is we don't see any of the other characters, Susan or Lobsang, in, but we do see Lute Say, who shows up in the next Watch novel, Night Watch, wherein from memory, quite a bit of enhanced interrogation takes place. So more on that when I get to those books.
Now all of this stuff about Doctor Who and Fukuyama and the end of history and 9/11 and all of that, it's all irrelevant, not only because it's not actually in the book, but because, as we all know, what really happens at the end of time is that the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse ride out, as they have done at least three times previously on Discworld, as recorded in the Light, Fantastic, Sorcery, and Interesting Times, and also at least once on Roundworld, or an alternate version thereof, as seen in Good Omens. Now, this idea, of course, is derived from the biblical Book of Revelation, which describes the apocalypse and God's final judgment on humanity, along with a war between a returned Jesus and the Antichrist. Did a bit of research into this. Didn't seem particularly relevant to Thief of Time, even less so than some of the stuff I've talked about here that I have chosen to include in this episode, but maybe I'll go into that more for the Good Omens episode. But yeah, from the research I have done, you know, the Book of Revelation is meant to be some kind of political allegory about the rise and fall of Rome or something, but it's mostly just remembered for having weird dragons and rivers of blood and shit. But it's in the Book of Revelation where we also get the canonical description of the Angel of Death, which I read out in the first episode on Mort, but it really doesn't give us any description other than that he rides a pale horse, with some newer versions variously translating that as green or grey as well. That is to say that there isn't a whole lot of insight into Death's character to be gleaned from the Book of Revelation, although it's rather interesting that in Revelation at least it is Jesus rather than Death whose description more accurately resembles that of the Grim Reaper. In Revelation 14:14, Jesus arrives to pass judgment on humanity with a sickle in his hand, and in the following verse, 14:15, an angel tells him to thrust in thy sickle and reap. The time has come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. Verse 14:18, Jesus is accompanied by another sickle-wielding angel who is commanded to reap the ripe grapes of the earth. And in verses 19-20, we are told that it is this winepress of the wrath of God that creates the river of blood that runs for 1,600 furlongs, which I'm told is approximately 322 kilometers and extremely metal. So yeah, this is the reaping and sickles and whatnot are drawing from the same symbolic history of Father Time and whatnot, and they are distinct from Death, who at least in Revelation is not shown as this sickle-wielding embodiment of time, at least, but it does seem like, you know, they could have gone and sort of branched out on their metaphors, not to get things too mixed up there, given that the Angel of Death and Father Time already had a bit of a monopoly on the whole reaping thing by the time of Saturn, at least, though, as discussed in the Mort episodes, the, you know, modern or common understanding of the Angel of Death as the skeleton holding the scythe doesn't really cement itself until the medieval period, whole Memento Mori movement and everything, so perhaps that was less recognizable at the time of the writing of Revelation. But yeah, there's a lot of things going on in Revelation. For the apocalypse is not just the final judgment and the end of the human race or the end of humanity as we know it, but it is the literal end of time. Or the metaphorical one about the rise and fall of Rome. But taking the text as read, yeah, it's meant to represent a literal end of time. In verse 10:6, God commands that there should be time no longer. And in verses 21:6 and 22:13, we get the well-known statements about God being both the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end, which, as well as being a super badass, is reminiscent of, you know, the circular mysticism of Taoism and even barbarous quantum collapse, although in that case, that's perhaps referencing Revelation more so. But yeah, this end of time, much like the vision presented by Pratchett in Thief of Time, is of everything becoming static so that there is no more change. I talked earlier about how there is therefore no more need for death, although there does seem to be time eternal still existing in the other realms of hell and the Holy Kingdom. Yeah, I don't know if there is too much more analysis to do regarding Revelation. The horsemen don't get any characterization than sometimes a brief physical description and the color of their horse. So I can't really apply that to the characters presented by Pratchett. While there are probably traditions feeding into the characterization of the other horsemen, as we discussed in the Mort episodes regarding death, I don't really want to take up any more time going into all of that. Perhaps, again, that is something that could be revisited for Good Omens. But this is just to say that these ideas of time and the image of the sickle-wielding, I was going to say time god, but Jesus as the judge of humanity there, is quite intertwined with the ideas of death as a figure and philosophical notions of time itself. Like, I do think we've only done the Witcher series to compare it to so far, but there does seem to be more of a link, a thematic link, between the death novels than there does in the other Discworld series, which are primarily parodies. You know, with the Witches, he's going to do fairy tales, and then he's going to do fairies, and he's going to do vampires and all of that, and the wizard books are direct parodies, and the watch of genres and things. Death, though, on paper, they seem a lot more disparate, that we're going from, you know, farming to music to Christmas to time. They all are circling around the identity of death himself, and they do seem to be a lot more theme rather than premise or parody forward novels. Even when it comes to Soul Music, which I think is the most blatant sort of parody novel of the Death series, as we discussed, there's a lot there tying it in and really setting up for these deeper metaphysical investigations of Hogfather and Thief of Time. So yeah, not too much to say about Revelation here, but I did want to pay it some acknowledgement and talk about the River of Blood, because that's just fucking cool. Okay, so I wanted to finish up our examination of the Death series by returning briefly to Susan, because with the exception of Reaper Man, which sort of stands alone within the Death series, it really is her story more than Death's. Like, his development is more or less complete by the end of Reaper Man and takes place entirely through Reaper Man, with a little bit bleeding over from Mort and then into Soul Music as well. But by the end of Soul Music, at least, Death's character arc is sort of done and the torch is passed over to Susan, with Death playing now this sort of more mature, all-knowing advisor and manipulator in the background. And even Mort is the history of Susan and her parentage. That was sort of her origin story for a given value of origin, even though she didn't exist yet. But yeah, I've started off all these books by looking at Susan's character first and foremost. And as we come to the end of the series, we have Imola Bogozi observing in her article about the curious case of Susan Sir Hellet from the Gender Forum special issue on Pratchett and the Discworld, that what may have started as a humorous inversion of roles in Soul Music has evolved into a complex character who displays an incongruous array of qualities traditionally branded as gender-specific. Susan, who was first described as a slightly built young woman in Soul Music, has by Thief of Time become a striking presence, whose physical prowess matches that of the heroes of old. She is a master of close combat, capable of hoisting the O-God of Hangovers and Tea Time over her shoulder with one arm, and is also capable of fading into the foreground, so that Pratchett writes, "Everything she stood in front of became nothing more than background." So if we look at Susan as an inversion, not just of female fantasy characters in general, but maybe even of her mother Isabel from Mort and her role in Mort more specifically, right? There she plays the love-struck, sort of capable but pompous and prissy background character, whereas Susan is a lot more independent, even though she's shown doting on a lot of men. She doesn't rely on them, and as Bugazzi points out, there is still an inversion of the damsel in distress in Thief of Time through Susan's, like, one encounter with Lobsang, where she winds up his timer when first meeting him in Uncle Morpork, which does sort of make their happily ever after love story at the end of the novel seem a little quite unearned, just that's the only time they really encounter each other. Though yes, I think that is the beginning of their relationship rather than the end. But we've seen Susan develop, which I think contrasts a lot with his other female characters who are quite static. Like, Granny Weatherwax is always Granny Weatherwax and learns things and develops, but her characterization is pretty solid from the start. Same with Nanny Ogg. McGrath is one who develops and changes and becomes more self-assured and more powerful, but she is, you know, at least playing at least third fiddle to Granny and Nanny. and is sort of done away with and relegated to being a mother as soon as she becomes one. Even Tiffany, who obviously gets a lot of focus development and also, you know, coming of age, maturing throughout her books, is sort of set up from the start as the capable, self-assured woman, and it's more about how she navigates social situations and is able to apply herself. But her internal characterization, at least from memory, maybe we'll see in 15 years when I get to him, how she develops more throughout the series. And Esk is just Esk from the start till the end, and again when she reappears in I Shall Wear Midnight. Whereas Susan, I think, ends up the furthest away from where she begins, which is not to say that she was incapable in soul music, but she was very demure and, you know, she had her whole thing about fluffy thinking and family and whatnot. And I think Pratchett does a huge amount of work in soul music to make that development stick. But then through her adventures in Hogfather and finally Thief of Time, we really do see her as a fully fledged character who, you know, literally stands out against the background. And yeah, despite her minimal appearance and sort of segregated role, is genuinely one of the standout mascot characters of the series. And for all that female and feminist inversions of traditional fantasy tropes are, you know, probably more abundant these days than the supposedly dominant male-oriented tropes they were originally inverting these days, I think Susan really stands apart as a distinctive, pioneering, and much more nuanced version of the character. Yeah, despite her relatively minimal presence in a popularist parody series. Unlike the early female barbarian characters in the Wizard series, or even Esk, who is just there to prove that women can be wizards, like, as we talked about in that episode, literally takes on the role of a man, more or less. Susan maintains a femininity to her, as Bill Godsey also points out, that although her strength, fearlessness, and prowess with a sword and keen analytical mind are traditionally considered masculine characteristics, Susan's build, style, and passion for quality chocolate and way with children are traditionally regarded as feminine qualities. And maybe that redeems the whole chocolate thing for me in the abstract a little as well. I mean, I still don't like the taste, but why should Susan be resented for enjoying things that women enjoy when she's a woman? And also, I mean, it's not Susan that's been resented, it's Pratchett for using that as a signifier of femininity. But maybe there's something more to that, and that it's not just him saying women be your shoes and things. Right, if we take McKee's point about sense-making and whatnot, it is that the enjoyment of chocolate and the humanity are valuable feminine qualities, and they shouldn't be gotten rid of in pursuit of this male ideal, right? The point is not to become a masculine figure. It is to become her own figure. At the same time, she ends the series redefining herself as only mostly logical in contrast to her steadfast and often overbearing rationalism that she's introduced with in soul music, which is another way Bugodzi says that Pratchett inverts the traditional associations between masculine logic and feminine emotion. But yeah, having Susan have to come into her emotions as well. Like, I can see a lot of the points, and we've discussed them at length, about Susan, you know, being a little bit shallow in her presentation plot-wise, but I think the character work is a lot deeper and a lot more nuanced than perhaps Pratchett is given credit for, which is why she and the Death series stand out so much. I mean, Susan has always been one of my absolute favourite Discworld characters. I have traditionally always thought of her and Granny Weatherwax as my two favourite characters, but of course, having gone through the Witcher series for this podcast, my estimation of Granny has dropped somewhat and been replaced by McGrat, who, yeah, I think is the only character in the books we've looked at so far whose development is comparable to Susan and is quite a similar character. So that perhaps speaks to my preferences and tastes. But yeah, she gets the development across the Witcher series, the story of her coming of age. That's the thread that holds them together. And she also gets to balance being the warrior queen with being a mother, right? It's the same thing with the chocolate, that McGrat shouldn't be looked down upon because she's a mother. That is only by doing away with the feminine-coded characteristics that's sort of playing into the sexism of the tropes they're meant to be subverting in the first place. Also at the end of Thief of Time, and I think far more developed in the books, both by page count and actual narrative depth, is that along with finding someone like herself in Lobsang, Susan also develops a pretty strong, if rather short-lived, friendship with Lady Lejeune, which, as Tansy Rayner Roberts notes in her unauthorized essays on Pratchett's women, is the closest thing we see to a female friendship for Susan since the schoolgirls from Soul Music, who didn't even really know her that well, and that they are an intense, complicated, and utterly awkward combination of two people who both have to work hard at pretending to be human. And Roberts, who, if you've been following along, is rather critical of Susan's characterization, does say that there are a couple of elements of Lady Lejeune, or Unity, as she comes to be known by the end of the book, there are a couple of elements of the way her character is handled that make Roberts uncomfortable, including the whole gendered joke about women's relationship to chocolate. But she says mostly Unity's self-diagnosis of her being completely insane and how that meant that she had to die. And I agree. This is, much as with Susan and Lobsang's romance, Lady Lejeune's, or Unity's, suicide at the end feels a bit cheap. I mean, I think it is somewhat built up to and earned in that her whole self-discovery and character development in a way is heading towards that ending, but I think it would have been nice for her to confront that, right? And keep it in line with the whole existentialism exploration that's been running through the death novels. If Unity is taken as a microcosm of death's own development and confrontation with existential despair that we saw in Reaper Man, the conclusion seems to be that it's all too hard, right? That when confronted with the pressures of reality and becoming her own self-defined person, that, you know, I'm not even going into the issues about ableism and the implication of insanity, but the seeming thematic necessity of suicide is not particularly encouraging. You know, I think you could have made the same point by having one of the other auditors like the taste of chocolate and react to it by killing themselves with the chocolate, which they essentially do, but you could have labored that point a bit more and maybe had Unity talk to Susan about her existential concerns and her suicidal impulses, and have Susan, who's now learned these things, talk to her about how existing is important and, you know, everything that Pratchett's been preaching throughout both Thief of Time and the other death books. And then maybe she could have joined Susan and Lobsang at the end and been part of this group of people like Susan, of Susan's tribe that she's found. And then that would have been a stronger, more general comment about human relationships and companionship, rather than this tacked on romantic bow tie on the end of Susan's story. But this is me sitting here, you know, armchair quarterbacking one of my favorite books of all time. So, you know, Pratchett probably knew what he was doing, but it does seem to fly in the face of the general thrust of the Death series, which has often confronted these existential conundrums. But as Death himself tells the other horseman, and by implication the reader in Thief of Time, the point is not that everything is hopeless. The point is that we must do what we can, and even if that doesn't work, it meant that we did what we could until we could not. Which is to say, to bring it all back on theme here, there is no justice, it's just us. That, following what I think is a very Sartrean existential humanist outlook, is that it doesn't necessarily matter if you succeed, it matters that you tried. And the only way anything is going to get done is because people have done it. So all of this is to say that at the end of the Death series, both Susan and Death have changed significantly while still being true to themselves. Invert everything, that there's no reason to hang on to the parts of ideas and things that made them so appealing in the first place. But yes, we can see very clearly that Death and Susan are very different people from who they were at the start of the book. I mean, they are people for a start, which is quite a big step, certainly for Death, but Susan a bit as well. But yeah, they are connected by the cookie dough chain of time to become who they are and have not stayed static. And that, according to Pratchett, is what's important.
Okay, so is it for both Thief of Time and the death sequence itself? It's been a bit of a journey for this one. I knew the death sequence was probably going to be one of, if not the most challenging of these sequences to go through. And I may have been a bit mature throwing it in second, but I also think it's very interesting and wanted to get to it. I don't know, maybe at some point I will end up revisiting some of these books and series down the track. But yeah, wasn't at all prepared
for a lot of the life changes and circumstances and things that added an extra level of challenge to the whole affair. And while I'm not super happy with how the whole thing turned out, I am happy that I persevered and was able to get through it, even if it took me roughly twice as long as I had intended. So I am continuing on these episodes. It might be at a slower, less regular or predictable pace, but I'm going to post a separate episode giving an update about that in the coming weeks, just about updating where I'm at with the show and how it's going to function from here on. Nothing, no major changes or anything, more just an acknowledgement that I'm probably not even going to pretend to be able to commit to any kind of regular schedule from now on. I think the update is basically going to boil down to they'll be done when they're done. But anyway, I'll go into more information about that when I record that. As far as the regular episodes themselves, having finished up the death sequence, I'm now going to move into, I guess, what I've been thinking of as the miscellaneous books, where we're getting into Miskworld territory again. These are the books that don't really fit in or can even really be associated with a particular sequence, being Pyramids and Small Gods, which, although they perhaps have the most similarity through the themes and things that they explore with the death sequence, as we'll see when we get to them. And then I'm also going to throw in Pratchett's non-Discworld novel, Good Omens, which he wrote with Neil Gaiman, because I think that also fits in and speaks to a lot of the same themes as Pyramids, Small Gods, and the Death series. So that is actually going to be the next book I'm going to be doing. And having started the research for it and Pyramids, I think it's the one that's going to work best in terms of the sequencing, which, much like the serendipitous coincidence of the Hogfather episodes getting delayed and then lining up perfectly with Christmas, this will line up just in time for the second season of the Good Omens TV show to be released, which I believe does not follow the book or even the proposed sequel that Pratchett and Gaiman had been throwing around. But I'll discuss that in those episodes. Before that, however, the long-promised, or I guess I should say long-threatened, vegetarian vampire episodes that I did with my friend Sophie, a vampire academic, almost a year ago now. They have been edited. They're finished. I mean, I've got to do a bit of tinkering, but I've gone through everything and they are sitting there ready to go. So I'm going to release all of those, and there's about 6 or so hours of podcast there. And that will give me a bit of time to put the Good Omens episode together, and then I'll be back with that when I can. But that will be the next sort of mainline Unseen Academicals episode that I'll be putting out, even though it is not a Discworld novels then. Yes, I'll be doing Pyramids, Small Gods if I can handle it. And then after that, I'm going to be going all the way back to the beginning and looking at Pratchett's three pre-Discworld novels, The Carpet People, The Dark Side of the Sun, and Strata, as part of this Miskworld sequence, but also in preparation for picking up again at the start of the Discworld series with the Wizard novels after I've got through all of that. So that is the broad outline for what's going to be happening with the show probably over the next year or so. But yes, more detail about that when I put out the announcement update. I mean, it's essentially everything I've just said there. Plus, I think I'm going to be shutting down the Patreon. But yeah, I'll go into more detail about that then. Anyway, I need to shut up and edit this together and post it so I can go to bed and you guys can listen to it. So yeah, that's it. Thanks for sticking with me. And yeah, keep an eye out for the update and the future episodes when they appear. Thanks for listening. Bye. And we're clear. The author shit. That's a nice Freudian slip there.